Hi, so I'm going to take a turn today and talk for a few minutes, if that's all right. And we'll see how far it goes, and maybe we'll continue in a week or two. It's a talk that I think is about something that everybody knows all about, but it seemed like possibly a good time to talk about some of it anyway. And it really has to do with the sense of spaciousness that arises in meditation and what that might suggest and where we can go with it. And there's an epigraph for the little talk, which is from Ezra Pound's Cantos, and it says, "Chicago ain't the whole punkin, Apovich." All right, so that's the epigraph. Right. So in meditation, and maybe in mindfulness practice especially, but not only, a lot of times we discover gradually or suddenly at least a somewhat altered relation to our own thoughts and an occasional or gradual sense of things getting more spacious. We've been reading in the Dharma Dialogue, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, so I'll read you the little passage by Suzuki Roshi that has something to do with this, and we've actually gone over this passage. "To give your sheep or cow a large, spacious meadow is the way to control him. So it is with people. First let them do what they want and watch them. This is the best policy. To ignore them is not good. That is the worst policy. The second worst is trying to control them. The best one is to watch them, just to watch them, without trying to control them. The same way works for you yourself as well. If you want to obtain perfect calmness in your zazen, you should not be bothered by the various images you find in your mind. Let them come and let them go. Then they will be under control. But this policy is not so easy. It sounds easy, but it requires some special effort. How to make this kind of effort is the secret of practice. Suppose you are sitting under some extraordinary circumstances. If you try to calm your mind, you will be unable to sit. And if you try not to be disturbed, your effort will not be the right effort. The only effort that will help you is to count your breathing or to concentrate on your inhaling and exhaling. We say concentration, but to concentrate your mind on something is not the true purpose of Zen. The true purpose is to see things as they are, to observe things as they are, and to let everything go as it goes. This is to put everything under control in its widest sense. Zen practices to open up our small mind, so concentrating is just an aid to help you realize big mind, or the mind that is everything." So what I want to look at mostly is some of the forms this kind of spaciousness, as the thoughts start wandering around like sheep in a bigger and bigger pasture, can take. But I want to start with a sort of common Zen 101 conundrum that at least a couple of people have mentioned to me recently. And that is, as soon as you are not thinking or your thoughts have gotten spacious, then you realize that you're thinking about how spacious they've gotten. And, you know, now you're thinking more than you ever were. So that's, if it's a problem, it's a problem that's completely characteristic of Zen practice. And I guess what I would want to say in the spirit of Suzuki Roshi is it's not really a problem. On the one hand, often it's a sign of nervousness that as things start to loosen, we have a tendency to want to hold on to them by thinking there's something wrong with what we've just done or wrong with how we corrected what we've just done. And the solution to that is just to notice that it's happening. But at the same time, and this is really crucial to our way of doing practice, I think, what we want to say is that we're people and so we think, and there's nothing wrong with that. And as Suzuki Roshi says in the passage that I read, the goal of practice is really not to stop our thinking. But it is maybe to realize that although there's nothing wrong with consciousness or our habitual thoughts are not the whole pumpkin, Apovich. So it's really good through practice to move from time to time to a place where there's thinking of various kinds, to a place where there's not so much thinking and maybe no thinking at all, and to have a sense of those really different spaces as part of who we are and where we inhabit. And through that practice, and this is something I think that happens to everybody, maybe gradually, maybe suddenly, maybe one step forward, two steps back, but you gradually begin to get some distance on your own particular thought habits and obsessions. So one of the things that tends to happen and that we work with is what Jonas started calling the deconstructive aspect and what she used to call the bucket work aspect of practice, where with as much patience and good humor and courage as you can, you really notice the thought patterns and the feeling patterns that come up, pay attention to them, get a feeling of how they've got you in a really sort of death grip sometimes, and at other times how they begin to thin out and make something else observable that's not exactly the same as they are. And in all those cases, I think what we're doing is noticing the world that we habitually live inside of that we barely ever notice. And sometimes it's a painful process, sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's just freeing. But getting a gradual distance from the extent to which we ordinarily are completely or very largely identified with our own cognition and our own thought habits is really useful. Another thing that will happen, well, let me get at it this way. In a recent talk by Norman that I was listening to, he was saying that it's remarkable to him, or it used to be remarkable, how hard it was for people to settle down in a retreat and how much was sort of exorcist thrashing around people had to do to get to the place of settling down. And I think part of that is the thinking, but it's also probably the affect. And so another thing that will tend to happen in prolonged meditation or frequent meditation is you'll notice the sort of passing feelings that go through your heart mind, but also in some sense maybe the underlying affect. And that can be pretty startling and pretty painful sometimes. And that's also, I think, part of the deconstructive or bucket work, that there's a feeling tone in our lives often that we don't take time to notice. And in meditation, we notice it, and it can be somewhat sobering or chastening sometimes. Just to make it more difficult, it can also be the case that the feeling we settle down with often is a masking feeling. And so you say, oh, that's actually not it, that there's something else underneath it. And actually that can be pretty happy sometimes, so that underneath the, you know, there's this sort of happiness that wants to rise that you're not letting arise. And so underneath what may seem to be a kind of dark or negative affect, there can often be something else. At any rate, as I said, that can be kind of difficult or also a revelatory kind of thing. And all this deconstructive aspect, it seems to me, sort of tends to hover over some odd questions that Zen students tend to bump into. So something like, what does the world feel like when it's freed up a little from your customary habitual thoughts? Like an odd question in a way. And then, what does the world feel like with these particular thoughts and habits of thought? And I know, at least for me, before I started practicing a lot, that wasn't a question that seemed available or useful to me. And then also, might some other world be possible with some other thoughts? Am I completely, you know, chained to the particular thoughts that I have? Everybody tends to go through an awful lot of that work, the deconstructive or the bucket work. Joan tends to also talk about it as a kind of purification that's important. One of the things that implies, which she stresses a lot, is that something else will tend to come to meet us as we do that. And I remember one or two talks where she said if it were only that, it would just be too hard, if it were just sort of relentlessly unpacking our own neuroses or whatever they are, but that something else will come to sort of move toward us if we'll let it. So in addition to that kind of karmic aspect of spaciousness, there are clearly Dharma aspects to it. So for me anyway, and I wanted to say when I started that these are just a few forms that spaciousness might take, and most of them are things that have happened to me, but it's by far from exhaustive, and I hope there'll be time for people to talk about their own senses of what happens when things start to get a little lighter and more spacious. So at any rate, one thing that can happen every once in a while is I'll get a sense really of being, I remember John saying to me one time, sort of at the end of it, he says, oh, and then it's welcome home to Tennyville, you know. So it's as if for a while you'd kind of been far enough away from your habitual thoughts that it's almost as if you could see that world from the outside. There's a really beautiful moment in Dante's Divine Comedy in the Paradiso where he's up on pretty high circle of heaven with his dead girlfriend Beatrice in this strange medieval poem. And she points to this little tiny thing down there, and he says, what is that? You know, and she says, it is that little threshing floor that makes men wax so fierce. It's the earth, you know, so you're seeing the earth as this tiny ball and this incredible sort of passion that goes on at it. And I think, you know, it's possible to have that relation to Tennyville or Karenville or Maryville as well, that you kind of look down on that and it seems really very far away in some way. For me, the other side of that is that returning to that has something of the feel of some of the Uchiyama passages that we were reading in the Dharma Dialogue group, that sense of the world is my world. So in some sense, I'm never outside my world. The world that I live inside, which is some combination of things coming in from from outside me and the way I process them and so on. I'll never really escape that world completely. It's born with me, it'll die with me. And it's possible, I think, to have a kind of tenderness and compassion both for that world and also for all the other people and creatures who kind of wander through there as guest appearances since they've entered. And now introducing Jen as Jen, you know, in the world. But so to have a sort of tenderness and solicitude for that. So to turn that around for a second, though, at the same time, I think one of the things that can happen in retreat, especially where you're moving between the cushion and walking around and doing other things, as the thoughts that you have tend to kind of thin out and you get this sense of spaciousness, I think it's almost as if we kind of got to the edge of our own atmosphere and could see a little beyond it. I want to be really clear. I don't think, you know, as I just said, we ever get sort of beyond our own perceptions. And the goal of Zen practice is not, though I used to think it was, you know, so finally you'll see things exactly as they are without any illusion, and then you'll see sort of reality instead. I don't think that nobody talks about practice that way after they've been doing it for a while. At the same time, there's a theorist of modernist literature who talks about modernist literature as being involved with defamiliarization. So there's a sense that sort of experimental literature sometimes will give you a really odd formulation of something that makes the creature or the object described kind of strange, as if you say, what is that? What am I looking at? And in that unfamiliarity, there's a sense of sort of the thing really impinging on you with a kind of vividness. So from poetry, I mean, a couple ones that I know there, Marianne Moore in a poem about a cat says it may be dangled like an eel. That's a really odd description, but if you think about picking up a cat, it really goes boneless on you. And so that moment of the cat like an eel where you say, well, what the fuck is that? Is also the moment where you say, oh, the cat, there it is. And then right after that she says, and I think you have to be a cat owner for this one, but it can also be set up on the forearm like a mouse, which is really odd. And you say, well, what is that? But cats are really able to balance on surfaces that are much smaller than you'd think they could. And if you have a cat who likes to be held that way, it really is sort of mouse-like in its ability to occupy that small space. So at any rate, that's an analogy, it seems to me. I'm trying to propose it as an analogy for the kind of thing that can happen in those moments where your thoughts have thinned out enough, where things impinge on you with a kind of vividness and startling quality. And it's as if the sort of veils between us and what's there are really thinned out, and so things can come forward. One of the crucial things of a moment like that, I think, is that, maybe this is just me, but I doubt it, if you have that kind of subject-object sense of the world, you know, here I am inside my head and I'm the thinker and everything else is stuff that I can see, that begins to kind of fall away and you're just one more thing in the midst of other things that are as vivid to yourself as you are, maybe. Similar kind of thing, it's not exactly identical, but I think at least with a lot of meditation, one thing that can happen is the borders of consciousness begin to get a little more porous and you become aware of more of the sensory input than you ordinarily would. So that's another way in which things get, I suppose, oddly spacious because there aren't so many of your intervening thoughts there. And in another sense, sort of oddly crowded because there's so many sensations and you're just one thing in the midst of them. I love this, a story in the biography of Suzuki Roshi where Graham Peachy, who was one of Suzuki's students, went to a 30-day meditation retreat, and he said by about halfway in the retreat, he could hear the bugs walking behind him on the floor. And I think that's the kind of thing that can happen in those moments. I remember one retreat moment where a fly sat on my hand and I could actually watch it opening and closing its eyes really fast, you know. So in some sense, the perception gets really fine. It's less sort of processed through what your concepts of the thing are, and there's a different kind of interaction between you and the rest of the world where, again, you kind of lose your foreground position. Joan likes to say in meditation, something comes to fetch you, or in practice, something comes to fetch you. And I think that kind of heightened sensorium where things are really impinging on you as the thoughts are less thick is one version of that. Another related thing might be that sense that you're just sitting there and along with the thoughts having thinned out, you're really in a space where, we've talked about this before, but where there isn't much narrative going on, where you're not telling yourself a story, where they're just these sensations kind of passing through you. And again, if the self is in some sense the manager of the story of your life, then as that narrative loosens, the sense of the self needing to control everything and be at the center of everything loosens as well. Another thing that I remember various teachers saying is that if you're counting your breath and things kind of slow down, that you can catch that little moment sort of between inhale and exhale where things are just really still. And that becomes a kind of gateway to the sense of the silence and the stillness and the eternal quality right at the heart of all that motion and noise and breathing and living. I'm going to quote one more little passage from Suzuki that we already talked about in that group, which is kind of about this. To live in the realm of Buddha nature means to die as a small being moment after moment. When we lose our balance, we die, but at the same time, we also develop ourselves, we grow. Whatever we see is changing, losing its balance. The reason everything looks beautiful is because it is out of balance, but its background is always in perfect harmony. This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature, losing its balance against a background of perfect balance. So if you see things without realizing the background of Buddha nature, everything appears to be in the form of suffering. But if you understand the background of existence, you realize that suffering itself is how we live and how we extend our life. So in Zen, sometimes we emphasize the imbalance or disorder of life. But the point I want to stress right now is that that's cheek by jowl right next to this sense of something spacious, eternal, and in that sense, you know, perfect, just the way it is. And in those moments, again, I don't think what we're doing is sort of seeing reality the way it really is, but we may feel that we're held by something that's vast and holds us just as it holds all the other things in that same space. From there, sometimes things get really dark, sometimes they get really light, sometimes Tathagata, you know, womp, there's something in front of you as real as it can be. The other thing I want to go back to just to end pretty much, and then maybe I'll tell one really quick dream, is that all this stuff, you know, for sure just comes and goes. Practice is also full of moments that don't feel spacious at all, at least to me. And I think that's fine too. And one of the things I'm aware of now is that before practicing, I kind of even maybe wouldn't have even noticed that. You know, now I'm completely caught up in my thoughts and my obsessions for this half hour in retreat, but it'll pass and something else will be there as well. In the Blue Cliff Record case too, Jasra says the great way isn't difficult, you just don't get to pick and choose. So whatever's going on is going on. So I think I'll tell just quickly one dream and won't talk about it too much. I had it a few months ago and I actually told Jen about it after I had it, but I woke up, nobody will remember this, but there was a time when we were doing the koan, the true Buddhas in the house, and that one right before that, there's a sentence in there that if you make a Buddha out of wood, when it passes through fire, it will surely burn. And Carol had a couple of really crucial dreams about sort of the fire and the Buddha and burning and all that. So sometime a couple of weeks after that, I woke up and I had this image in my head and then a phrase, and it was cleaning the carpets while the house is burning. And I woke up with this idea that I was very vivid that the house was burning around me, but I was determined that I was going to clean the carpets and not pay any attention to the burning house, you know. So my sense is that, I mean, this is sort of silly, but in one sense, the spaciousness that I've been talking about is the spaciousness that allows you to stop sort of obsessively focusing on the carpets that you need to clean, and, you know, which pretty clearly sometimes is a dogged and determined effort not to admit to yourself that the house is burning, and actually back up enough so that you know that the house is burning. So that's, I think, partly a kind of karmic image, you know, that is to say, what are the things, and this is part, again, of the sort of discomfort that people can feel sitting and the difficulty settling down, but as your attention loosens enough so that it's impossible to spend the entire retreat simply worrying that you haven't finished cleaning the carpets, you sort of move to a more spacious, larger horizon where you might notice, for example, that the house is burning, that there are more serious and difficult things to, to think about that, you know, you've been trying to keep out of range. The other thing I want to say about the dream is it seems to me it's also a kind of Dharma image in that sense that in some sense the house always is burning. So one of the things we're told is that, I think this is the Buddha himself, I can't remember for sure, but that you need to sit as if your hair is on fire. So that sense that you're always in the throes of this universe that's a fire and burning, that's really important also. Another thing that meditation will make clear, though, this is a different image of it from the An Lushan rebellion a long time ago, but a poet then, a Zen poet says, when China was really wrecked by this rebellion, he says, the nation is destroyed, rivers and mountains remain. So, you know, the house is burning, you're dying, but rivers and mountains remain. And then the last thing, and then I'll stop, is that, do you remember Marie a couple weeks ago saying that if she realized she were dying, she had said, what would I do? She said, well, I'd get up and feed the cats and do the ordinary things. So for me, the other thing about that, you know, cleaning the carpets while the house is burning in relation to Zen practices, after I realized that the house is burning, you know, but maybe it's not going to burn for another 5 years or something, well, what am I going to do today? I'm going to clean the carpets. So that seems important as well. And Joan loves the teacher talking about how the end point of Zen practice is just to lead an ordinary life. So for the house to be burning and to clean the carpets seems to me to be one way to use the spaciousness of Zen practice. So that's it for now. Thank you. So there's probably a lot that I left out.
There's probably a lot
that's not true. But how is it for you? I mean, probably everybody from time to time.
I'm still a little bit chewing on the part you about affect. Go back to that. What were you saying there?
I think, for me anyway, if I sit a retreat, and I'm not as surprised by it as I used to be, because I think I pay more, but it's like when you actually slow down enough to sit for a day or two, you may touch a level of sort of habitual feeling tone that's usually not conscious and can be fairly surprising. I think the more you practice, maybe the less that's true, but I mean, you know, from time to time I'll get, oh, so that's how I've been feeling the last couple months. And then there's that other one, it's like, oh, I feel terrible, you know. And it's, actually, no, things are getting really great, and that's a sort of masking thing for it. You know, that can also be true. One of the retreats where things really started to open up to me, I remember Joan saying, well, this is really strange because you're having this wonderful retreat, but the main thing you're reporting is anxiety. You know, I said, oh, okay.
When you were talking about that, the thing that came to my mind was, well, myself on a retreat, reaching an affect level fairly quickly. And I was talking to Joan, and she goes, oh, that's very hopeful. I said, oh, really? She said, well, yes, I think they're threshold demons.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
They're what?
Yeah.
Threshold
yeah. Yeah.
demons.
Oh.
And
yeah.
So I don't remember how she explained it to me. The translation for me, the image that came in my mind were like, you know, those little tiny Muppet babies, but with fangs and like claws, and
yeah.
and they were like, because she, the way she described it was, you know, they're clutching at your ankles and trying to keep you from letting the house burn, really.
Yeah.
And when she said that, I had a whole new perspective. Rather than wallowing in this pile of affect, I was like, oh, so I can choose to not take these so seriously and picture them as these
yeah.
little Muppet babies with fangs and just kind of see what happens if I don't pay much attention. And
yeah.
that's when the spaciousness happened. But if she hadn't done that translation, I probably would have
yeah, that,
retreat, just wallowing.
That's great. That's exactly what I meant. And one of the things I remember saying about something like that is if you're in a retreat and your affect starts to get really turbulent or dark, it's worth trying to just brush it aside and seeing if it's a threshold demon. She also used the metaphor of like it was one of her students, all the chihuahuas start nipping at your heels when things start getting deep because they really don't want that to happen. And then what she says is, well, if you really try that a lot and it doesn't work, I mean, it could just be that the threshold demons are really hungry,
mm-hmm.
but it could also be they're not threshold demons and there's something you don't quite want to learn about how you're really feeling in a deep way.
Yeah, that's the part that for me is like, sitting quietly, maybe it's a threshold meeting, but I can't, I don't understand the bad about preventing you from going deep. But I think that when things come up that are haven't been up before or that have remained suppressed for whatever reason, that that acknowledging them or being with them or whatever, working through it allows you to go deep.
Right.
So it's both.
Yeah.
You know, and it's
yeah.
important, I think, not to necessarily ignore them, but to explore them.
Yeah. That I mean, I agree with that, and I was sort of trying to. Right, that sometimes you learn about a really important feeling or that you didn't want to face, and at other times it's that the you remember the Buddha thing about when after he awakens under
right,
the tree,
right.
he says, "Can you stand this happiness? You know, can you bear this?" And that's that other thing that things are really opening up in a really big way. That's potentially very joyous sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm. But
and
it can be frightening.
One of the responses to that is, I can't let that happen. Here are the 100 reasons why I'm a terrible shithead and it can't happen to me.
You know? But even in the same way, you can have that happen. And it's so unfamiliar and so not your experience of the world that it's scary because it's an unknown.
Right.
Not because you judge yourself. It's just,
right.
it's just something.
Right. But that, yeah. Right.
Yeah,
right. Right.
The concept of yourself
yeah.
in a way.
Yeah.
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 yeah. Well, yeah, exactly what I meant, and I think this what Jill was saying too is that it's so scary that you'll bring anything to your aid to prevent it that you can, even if it's not true. Oh, I'm really worried about this. I can't have this experience.
Yeah.
You know. So.
Something else that has stayed with me is that image of, you know, with the spaciousness, that things would come fetch you. And I had a very visual image. I mean, first it's just meditating, so you're not filled with this, like, talking to somebody or having the radio on or busy, busy, busy. You know, there's that opening. And then when the thoughts are, like, I just had the image of just, like, cartoon where there's, like, the thought cloud and, you know, it could just be filling the whole panel. through versus the thoughts, like, little, you know, numbers of little bubbles, and I'm like, oh, there's actually some space for something. It's nice.
That's great.
I had one I think I mentioned that I like because the disproportion is so weird and for me characteristic of practice. When John was doing a retreat here a few years ago, he was doing morning greeting. And he's a little scary, I think. I mean, at least he can be. But I remember, so I was there, he was walking by, and I thought, he really sees I'm doing something wrong. Like, it's not, I don't have it together. So, you know. And then I had this moment right after he passed, I thought, maybe he didn't think that, you know? And I later, I told him about it, and he said, no, actually, I don't, you know, I just feel really grateful that everybody's willing to practice with me and stuff. I'm sure it's a little more complicated, but anyway, it was right. I mean, he didn't think that at all. And it was just this silly little thing, you know? And everything, I mean, the entire world was like radiant and beautiful and sort of like Grand Peachy here in The Bugs Walk on the Floor for me for about 8 hours after that. I mean, just this little thing, oh, the picture of the world I have about this one thing might not be true, and the way I feel in relation to that interaction with John might just be something that was entirely a function of my world and had nothing to do with what was going on. I was like, whoa. You know?
Well, I think I'm thinking about your teacher ceremony and some of the words I said, and just how, to me, how important it is to have a teacher, someone who's got a foot over the threshold and in the world, and making that invitation to spaciousness, and I think that's the gift of having a teacher, is that, you know, sometimes we're so stuck in our stuff we can't really identify where do we go with this, what, you know, we're kind of stuck in it, and you know, the invitation coming from that teacher who represents spaciousness is really critical, I think.
Yeah.
And
that's great. Yeah.
It has been for me. I mean, that's what I can say.
Can I say one thing that John said to me sort of when I was doing teacher preparation with her, which was really interesting, I thought? She said, well, so if you teach, you agree to, the point for me would be that it's really transactional, you know, so what she said is like, if you teach, you agree to try to occupy that place for people, but don't ever believe that you really, that you know, that 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 you occupy that place and not the same place that everybody, you know. So everybody's just as stuck in, you know, do you know what I mean? So,
yeah. Right. Yeah. And yet that's part of what's required. I mean, having that grounding in what everybody else is experiencing is, to me, what's required from a teacher to be able to make that invitation that's so enticing.
Yeah.
You know, that's the gift of a teacher, to be able to have that understanding.
So it's like the Winnie the Pooh thing. Heave ho, you know, trying to get poo out of the honey hole.
The whole word spaciousness is interesting, because what does it mean? You know, I mean, all the things you're talking about, you kind of allude to it, and but it's like, you know, emptiness, or there's a lot, and it's not something you really can put your finger on, you know, or I don't know. I don't know what it brings up in me, but something that's I don't know if I can really relate to it, I guess.
That's great. I mean, I think that's definitely right. And it is just a metaphor.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you said it, because I picked it up from, you know, John and Joan and other teachers. And so for me, I almost don't think about it as a metaphor anymore, but it is. I mean, it's just one way to try to give an image of something. It isn't exactly that. That's
well, again, I guess it's the difference in the focus of practice, you know, between maybe your practice and my lineage, because that's not the most important thing. Is our practice and living our lives, not some spaciousness that we're going to acquire or that we're going to. And it's not that it doesn't happen along the way, but it's just interesting to think about it in this way. Which is very different than the way I would normally think about practice or sitting or so.
Yeah. I think that's right, and I think in the tradition that our, you know, the Joan John Diamond Sangha tradition, the same thing is also, they would say the same thing, that the goal is just what you said it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the danger would be maybe that in our tradition that you get stuck with the fascination with spaciousness or something else. And so you don't sort of roll it over.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the whole intent of it, to find it, is so that you can do good in the world or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different way of approaching it, I think, or something.
And
maybe that's why it's I'm trying, you know, this part of me that wants to say, what is this?
Right.
You know, and not that I expect to be able to nail it down and figure out what that really means, but it's the whole process of all the things you went through, but thinking, different ways of thinking about it.
It's interesting, because I don't think of you as very much like Natalie Goldberg at all, but I mean, she, you know, who's also long time, but she's got very, very similar, you know, responses to it, that she just doesn't, for her practice, is not interestingly about that at all.
Yeah.
Is she a Buddhist?
Yeah, she's Soto.
Kanagiri Roshi is her teacher.
She apparently was gonna teach, and then he died, and things happened, and so she didn't. But she'd been working with him for a long time, and she was gonna be a Roshi.
He was a Roshi in Minneapolis.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And he was the guy who was Suzuki's assistant.
Yeah.
I guess
that's
it. So.
Japanese guy.
Yeah.
Sorry. Just a definition question. You know, when you talked about, you know, deconstructing, but then you used the word the bucket work. What do you mean the bucket work?
To me it means a couple of different things. So one thing it means is like bailing out the bucket, you know. So there's that, or taking the bucket to do the endless work, and I think that's how she's using it. But the other thing that I know she's aware of and uses a lot is there's a very, very classic Rinzai Cohen image of, it's sort of a term of abuse. It's like, oh, you lacquer bucket. It's like, you're this big tub of lacquer or something like that, that's all stuck in a bucket. And what happens is, in a moment of opening, the bottom drops out of the bucket. And then everything is just in this enormous space. So my hunch is that bucket work mostly means the bailing out thing, but it's also the work of letting, you know, doing the, filling the bucket full enough that the bottom will pop out of it. And you'll be in kind of infinite space.
You said that too. Is it that image of the moon and the water, was that a bucket too, or was that in the well?
It would be really complicated to track the relation among them. I think the one relation is that when Mujaku sees the moon in her bucket, which is this incredibly beautiful moment, that there's a kind of limitation to that, as Joan talks about it, where for her it's as if enlightenment is this sort of special thing that's got to be held carefully and contained. Mm-hmm. And in that sense too, in a way, the bottom will drop out of her bucket and something else will happen. So, yeah.
Can I ask an unrelated question?
Yeah.
Nothing to do with anything.
Yeah.
But what is Kansion mean?
Swan Yin, the bodhisattva of compassion.
So it's a Japanese word.
Yeah.
It's a name, Japanese name for Kuan Yin.
Or
I mean, this depending on the kind of Buddhism, they have different names, but it's the same person.
And Avalokiteshvara is also that same person.
Yeah.
Who's the Tibetan?
Yeah.
Thousand-armed Chenrezig is another one.
So it's kind of gender ambiguous or androgynous in some way, right? It's like,
though most often it's female.
Right.
Most often.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Avalo is more the gender, right? Sort of the. I mean, Kanzeon is more female. Avalo seems like it's more. Don't know.
I think that's right.
And then what is the word that's the T, the Tathagata, whatever?
Tathagata.
That's the Buddha. Is that a name?
That's
a concept.
It's a name for the Buddha, and as Suzuki talks about it, it means sort of thus come, you know, here it is, right? Thus gone,
okay.
Right? And also, this is a sort of bad English, but true suchness. So the thing exactly that comes and goes is the, do you know what I mean? So true suchness kind of implies, the essence or something like that.
I say thusness too. Sometimes.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Funny.
The thusness is better than true suchness. I like that better. Yeah. So thusness, but also exactly that which is born and dies, that which comes and goes. And so, you know, so no old age and death, and also no ending of old age and death. That's that.
So can somebody just say it again? Because this is the one, I'm glad you asked. I can never say it. I skip it when we're...
Tathagata.
Tathagata.
I can't say it. Go ahead.
Tathagata.
It's a TH.
Even though there's a TH in there, you don't pronounce any THs.
They put an H in it to trick you, but it's not. Tathagata.
Tathagata.
Yeah.
Tathagata. I think what happens for me is I hear you say it, and I hear you say it at different times. Like you're not in unison, and I'm then like, what is that one?
Or I'm trying to hear the H somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, can I just do one other thing as long as we're doing that? And we got to go. So in the... In the refuge, that, you know, Buddham Saranam, you know, Buddham Sama. So a couple things. So one is that it's Dhammam, because it's Pali or Sanskrit. So it's like an older version of it. And then the other one is that we also say Gacchami, and that's a function of Richie setting it to music, and it's Gacchami. And it made Carolyn Lee so mad that she couldn't stand it and she had to leave. No, she sat there, but she really couldn't stand it. So it's not Gacchami, it's Gacchami. But Richie knew that, but he wanted to make the rhythm work.
Well, that's my difficulty with it. I have to just sit through and keep doing it and letting it go.
Yeah.
Not just that, but the whole thing. Because these are all chants that are done traditionally in a lot of different places, but it's not to music, and they change the words. And every place you go, the words are slightly different, but... It's like,
you speak
just
to
be here now.
Not judgment.
Well, it's just letting go. I can't let go into it.